When my mother was a child, her aunts used to take her to the cemetery to visit her father's grave. Apparently, this was not a particularly sad thing for them to do. The aunts would pack a picnic lunch and travel from the Bronx to the wilds of New Jersey in order to have a chat with their brother Harry. Harry had died tragically in an accident at the age of 33 back in the year 1934, leaving behind a wife and two small children, including my mother. Harry was not the oldest sibling, but he was the boy, and so he was special, the one they looked up to. In their immigrant family, he not only was a university graduate, but a leading Zionist. He was one of the founders in the United States of Hapoel HaMizrahi, the Orthodox Zionist organization. Encouraging Jewish settlement in Palestine was his passion. My grandparents spoke only Hebrew to their children in their New York City apartment, so that Hebrew would actually be their mother tongue. Harry even purchased a parcel of land in Israel back in the 1920s, but he did not live to visit the land himself. Almost everything I know about him can be found in the preface to a book published in his memory 6 years after his death. It's called Jew and Arab on the Border, and it's about the founding of Tirat Tzvi, the first Orthodox kibbutz. In any event, the aunts would take my mother and her little brother to picnic at his grave, where his sisters would quite frankly catch him up on family affairs and ask his advice about them. I'm not sure exactly how they divined his response to their queries, but apparently their regular visits were a source of both comfort and inspiration for them. Knowing this bit of family lore, it often struck me as odd that my parents did not carry on the tradition of visiting family plots, even around Rosh Hashanah, as so many Jews do. By the time I was in college, all three of my remaining grandparents had passed away, but I don't remember my parents ever returning to their graves after the unveiling. As to the site of my mother's childhood picnics with her aunts, there is no one left who could tell me with a certainty, not even my mother, just where Harry Karp was laid to rest. I know that I'm not alone in this. On the one hand, we Jews trace our ancestry back over 3,000 years to Abraham and Sarah. Our strong, even visceral connection to our past is one of our most defining characteristics. And yet, ironically, many of us know nothing about our more immediate ancestors, how they lived and died, or where, or even their complete names, or where they are buried. As a result of the great upheavals of the 20th century, two world wars, mass migration, and the Holocaust, American Jewish families are not likely to have ancestral plots. And even after several generations transplanted into American soil, it is as likely as not that we live in different cities than where we were raised, and that our children will live still in other parts of the country. Yet, the tradition of visiting those graves that we are physically able to persists, particularly at this season. And my never having fulfilled this custom myself left me with a void, a sense of rootlessness, and a feeling of obligation that needed to be redressed. Sometimes I would talk to my kids about researching the missing data and maybe taking a road trip to visit the graves of my grandparents. But the information I sought seemed out of reach, and nothing came of it. Then about a year ago, something changed. My family decided to finally sell that parcel of land that Harry had purchased so many years before. What was then a sand dune was now within the city limits of Holon, near Tel Aviv. The sale required a death certificate for my long-deceased grandmother, so I ordered a copy of it online. And there, written in my father's familiar handwriting near the bottom of the certificate, was the name of the cemetery where Ima, we used to call our grandmother Ima, was buried, Riverside Cemetery in Saddlebrook, New Jersey. I called them up. Yes, they could tell me where Hadassah Karp Gabriel was buried. But what about Harry Karp, who died 40 years earlier, I asked them. Was he buried there too? Yes, but in an older section, not far away. That's all I had to hear. My road trip was on. My son Jonah decided to join me. It would be his only chance to visit these cemeteries before moving to Israel, and we set a date in July, about a month before his departure. Since he was coming, we decided to visit the burial plots of the great-grandparents on both sides of the family in what would be an all-inclusive tour of the graves of the Robbins-Lieben ancestors. The itinerary grew to include six cemeteries, oddly enough, all conveniently located between exits 130 and 160 on New Jersey's Garden State Parkway. We would start early in the morning from my mother-in-law's house in Westfield, exit 135, take a short dip south, and then spend the rest of the day heading north, ending up for dinner with cousins in Manhattan. On the morning of our trip, we got into the car, armed with water bottles, sunglasses, maps, and a GPS. We saw the graves of Rabinowitzes who arrived in Newark at the turn of the century, and of their children, now named Robbins, of my wife's beloved grandparents, who lived into their 90s, whom my children adored, and a slew of Liebens near and dear to me, but whom my own kids never knew. Wending our way north on the highway, our pilgrimage developed a pattern. Every few exits, we got off the parkway, drove to the next cemetery, hunted through the rows of graves until we found our quarry, and then we read aloud the words inscribed in stone. We shared a few memories, if it was a person we had known in life, before chanting El Malei Rachamim, the memorial prayer, and placing stones upon the headstone, a tangible sign that the life of this person was not forgotten. And that's how we spent the better part of a day, sprinkling memories, prayers, and pebbles northward on the Garden State Parkway. The journey was neither morbid nor particularly sad. In the act of articulating the inscriptions on each stone, I felt as if something came alive, a connection and a sense of gratitude to these members of our family, whether I knew them in life or knew them only through snippets of family stories. Cemeteries remind us that our lives are not completely limited by our years, that we walk on a path that was begun long ago, and that when we are gone, others will be there to continue the journey for us. Even Abraham, the first Jew, the iconoclast, who originated the idea of one God, had a history and a family that prepared him to be who he became. According to the Torah, it was Abraham's father, Terach, who first began the journey to Canaan, who got him as far as Haran, which is where he encountered God. None of us got to this moment on our own. In ways of which we are aware and in ways in which we may never know, we stand on the shoulders of generations now lying at rest. On Yom Kippur, we are asked to confront our own deaths. Only 1 week after celebrating the boundless possibilities inherent in the new year, we come right smack up against our boundedness, our mortality. We starve our bodies and feel their weakness. Death echoes throughout the day's liturgy. We recite Yizkor for our departed, the Eila Ezkara in memory of our martyrs, and the Vidui, the confession of sins, just as we are commanded to do when we prepare to die. It is a tradition to wear a white kittel today to remind us of the shroud in which we will be buried, and even the morning Torah reading begins with the death of Aaron's sons. And near the beginning of the Musaf Amidah, we recite once again the words of the Unetana Tokef prayer as we did on Rosh Hashanah, who shall live and who shall die. But today the words seem even more severe than they did last week. And yet, here we are. We choose to be here because we believe that Yom Kippur, this rehearsal of death, prepares us to live better, more thoughtful lives. We perceive that there are things we need to learn about ourselves and that death itself is our teacher. Some 6 years before his untimely death this week, Steve Jobs gave a commencement address at Stanford University, and in prescient terms, he urged the graduates to, quote, live each day as if it is your last, because one of these days you'll most certainly be right. He He went on, "When I first heard that advice at age 17, it made an impression on me. And since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important thing I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked." Steve Jobs was right. An important lesson that this rehearsal of death can teach us is perspective. We open ourselves to consider what is really true about our lives, stripped of the confusion of pettiness, of pretense, and self-deception. A Hasidic rabbi once punned, "How is Yom HaKippurim a day Kippurim?" Or in other words, how is Yom Kippur like Purim? Because on Purim we wear masks, but on Yom Kippur we take them off. This is a day for unvarnished truth. There is, however, a gentler flip side to this message that we have a tendency to overlook. Facing our limitations, we allow ourselves to say Al-Chet, to admit that we have sinned. But facing our limitations, we also allow ourselves a measure of forgiveness and compassion. In our often self-deluded pride, we hold ourselves to standards that can never be met and set ourselves up for cycles of failure and guilt. The blessing of Yom Kippur, yes, the blessing of Yom Kippur, is that it teaches us humility and allows us to accept that what is possible is usually good enough. I'm not suggesting that we cease to strive for excellence or that Judaism in any way encourages mediocrity, only that we hold our sense of self-importance a little lightly. Rabbi Tarfon taught, "Lo alecha hamalacha ligmor, velo ata ben chorin lehibatel mimena." You are not obligated to complete the task, but neither are you free to desist from it. This is a day to ask ourselves, what am I capable of doing in this moment, in this life? What small part of the whole is up to me? The world may not be redeemed in our lifetime, but each of us has a role to play, and the work will surely continue after we have gone. On that July pilgrimage up the Garden State Parkway, the emotional center for me, the reason why I had even begun the trip, was the search for Harry's grave, the one grandparent whom I had never met and whose headstone I had never seen. Jonah and I picked up a site map from the office of the Riverside Cemetery of Saddlebrook, on which the name Harry Karp was neatly recorded in a rectangular box indicating his plot. We proceeded. Walking up the road toward Section 5, old, full trees blocked out the sun as if we had wandered out of the cemetery and into a forest. A deer darted out from behind a hill and stared at us before running off ahead as if she were showing us the way. The Hebrew word for deer is Tzvi, which is my grandfather's Hebrew name and my own, and I felt as if the two of us, Jonah and I, were expected, as if someone had been waiting for us for a very long time. Section 5 was old and overgrown. Even with an office map, finding an old grave takes a bit of hunting, all the more so when many of the stones themselves are thick with brambles and bushes. We finally arrived at what we thought was the right spot, but couldn't be certain until we hacked away at the prickly foliage that almost completely covered it. And then there it was. A tall, narrow stone that rose to a triangular point decorated in a 1930s Art Deco style revealed itself. The rather lengthy inscription, written only in Hebrew, included a poetic tribute to Harry's scholarship and to his devotion to Israel, and the hope that his death at such a young age would intercede in heaven on behalf of the wife and children that he left behind. I'd never seen anything like this stone. And then I read the date of his death. Hey, Iyar, the 5th of Iyar, the same day upon which, 14 years later, David Ben-Gurion would announce the independence of the State of Israel. I did not know until that moment that my grandfather's yard site is Yom HaAtzma'ut. Now I have a date to say Kaddish for Harry that I couldn't possibly forget. And more than that, the date symbolizes the arc of his life's work, which was only completed through the collective efforts of so many other people years after his death. In the Torah portion, Ha'azinu, which we read in the synagogue last week, God tells Moses to ascend the heights of Moab to Mount Nebo and to view the land of Canaan, which lay in the distance across the Jordan River. Ki mineged tire et ha'aretz v'shama lo tavo. You shall view the land from a distance, God tells Moses, but you shall not enter it. The Torah reiterates here that Moses is denied entrance into the land because he had disobeyed God at the incident of Meribah. Moses had struck the rock, causing water to gush forth rather than speaking to it. He had displayed anger and frustration where what God had required was a display of compassion and forbearance. Among the Bible commentators, everyone's got an opinion. Wasn't the punishment disproportionately harsh to the offense? After everything Moses did over 40 years, didn't he deserve better from God? Why is God taunting Moses by bringing him to the very edge of fulfilling his life's dream without letting him complete it? But I think that such questions miss the point. Moses cannot enter the promised land because no human being can ever achieve all of his goals in this life. Our dreams are limitless, our years are not. And as long as we live, there will always be a next chapter that we want to write, and death will inevitably keep us from completing it. Had Moses succeeded in entering the promised land, then the Torah would become a fairy tale rather than a guide to living in this world, and Moses would be nothing more than an action figure rather than a model of human striving and frailty in whom we can all see a reflection of ourselves. So Jonah and I looked at each other, not knowing quite what to say. Here we were, standing in front of the grave of a grandfather and a great-grandfather whom we had never met. 1934 seemed so long ago, another era. What would he have thought of our world? How could he even have imagined the 21st century, or us? And yet there we stood, knowing that we were a continuation of Harry's story. We often have the illusion that our lives are all our own, that we are autonomous human beings, the masters of our fate. But the truth is, our ancestors all had their small role in shaping the lives that we, their descendants, have chosen to live. And we, in our acts and in our remembrances, give them a measure of immortality through an unbroken thread. For the first time in many decades, Harry's stone was decorated with small pebbles, leaving it larger than we had found it. Before we finally walked on, Jonah and I sang old Zionist songs with a grandfather and a great-grandfather who never knew us, but whom we think would have liked that. In the Yizkor section of Machzor Lev Shalem, you will find the following poem by Rabbi Harold Schulweis. Looking backward, we recall our ancestry. Looking forward, we confront our destiny. Looking backward, we reflect on our origins. Looking forward, we choose our path, remembering that we are a tree of life, not letting go, holding on and holding to. We walk into an unknown, beckoning future with our past beside us. The humidity of the July afternoon had the scent of summer picnics. And I remembered, of course, this is the spot where my mother's aunts would spread out their blanket and talk to Harry. I hope that someday grandchildren will come to picnic at my grave, to catch me up with the family news, or to sing an old Hebrew song. I don't really believe that I will hear them. I know I won't. But they will feel held in my embrace, nevertheless. And they will know that they stand on the shoulders of those who came before them. Lishana tova techatemu.